Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been giving live coverage to the state funeral of President Ronald Reagan in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C., where assembled dignitaries have just heard from the Vice President, Dick Cheney, from House Speaker Dennis Hastert, and from Alaska's Senator Ted Stevens, President Pro Tem of the U.S. Senate. I've been talking to Gail Shattuck in Washington, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who's been describing the scene on and around Capitol Hill. We're joined as well now from Washington by E.J. Dionne, columnist for the Washington Post. His new book is Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Tufts, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. He's a senior fellow in government studies at the Brookings Institution. E.J. Dionne, thanks for joining us this evening.
It's great to be with you.
I'm sure you've been watching and listening, as we all have. Your thoughts on this quite grand and particular ceremony we're witnessing this evening?
Right. Well, it's hard not to be moved when you see the casket roll into the Capitol Rotunda and hear those words about President Reagan as a good and graceful and gallant man. Vice President Cheney said, what lingers from that time is almost all good. Well, that actually is going to be a politically controversial statement, and I think we will have a debate on the Reagan legacy after all of this is over. But at this moment, it just feels like, as Gail said, a national moment. You ask Gail a good question, which is there the same kind of unity here? And it struck me over the last several days. I wrote a column earlier this week on Ronald Reagan, and I'm obviously my own politics are not similar to his at all, but mm-hmm. I talk primarily about what people could learn from Ronald Reagan, both among liberals and conservatives. And it shows how contentious those times were, that I got a lot of emails from people who usually agree with what I write, basically disliking the fact that I had chosen right after he died not to emphasize the points of disagreement, but the points of agreement. So I think that after these ceremonies pass, we will have a political discussion of this. The other thing that's striking, of course, as somebody said earlier on your show, is these events are moving and national. They are also political. And what is being done here, as was done with Franklin Roosevelt by Democrats and as was done earlier for Abraham Lincoln, with Abraham Lincoln by Republicans, is we're in the process of creating a legacy, not only for a man, but also for a political movement. And he was very much a leader and a product of a political movement. And so I think in the country, among people who are not part of that political movement, there's a little bit of reaction against sort of the ways in which this can become politicized.
A sense of being on the outside looking in for a moment.
I'm sorry?
A sense of being on the outside looking in for a moment.
Right, in a sense that a state occasion, an occasion which in many ways does unify us, I think all of us in different ways admire the fact that the end of the Cold War was hastened by Ronald Reagan. Some emphasize mm-hmm. the arms buildup. Others emphasize the fact that he was one of the first people to embrace Mikhail Gorbachev. I think one of the things about Reagan that I pointed out in that column earlier this week that my liberal friends didn't like so much is that he showed remarkable flexibility at times. And I think in seeing Gorbachev as a different sort of leader, as somebody who was, as Reagan put it, a serious reformer, he helped end the Cold War not by just the arms buildup, but also by embracing the possibility of change. And, of course, Gorbachev wrote a very powerful piece in the New York Times.
E.J. Dionne, one moment. The Senate chaplain is offering a prayer.
Whose love for freedom summoned our nation to embrace our best hopes and not our worst fears. Thank you for his ability to plant seeds of confidence and not doubt, and to lift liberty's lamp until totalitarian towers tumbled. in the days to come, remind us of America's opportunity to remain a shining city on a hill. Continue to comfort those who mourn. In a special way, be near to Mrs. Nancy Reagan and the family. May the death of this beloved leader prompt us to see you more clearly, to love you more dearly, and to follow you more nearly, day by day. Now fill us with your peace as we trust you, so that we may overflow with hope by the power of your Spirit. Amen.
Senate Chaplain, Navy Rear Admiral Barry Black, offering closing prayer. Wreaths have been set before the casket of Ronald Reagan, including by Vice President Dick Cheney, who now stands with Nancy Reagan on his arm and is approaching the casket of Ronald Reagan. Dick Cheney, Nancy Reagan at his side, slowly walking forward to the center of the rotunda, military honor guard still nearby. Nancy Reagan now resting her hands on the American flag that drapes the coffin of Ronald Reagan and caressing that flag and the casket beneath, patting that casket, speaking, it seems, to the casket. Her head bowed. And slowly beginning to turn away, caressing the red and white stripes, and with a final caress, leaving the casket with Vice President Dick Cheney at her side. Gail Shattuck, these are very, very intimate moments to be witnessed by an entire nation, by the world.
You know, as you saw her pat the casket the way she did, you couldn't help but think of the number of times you'd seen her do that, you know, during his presidency.
On his arm.
On his arm.
E.J. Dionne and this famously close couple, throughout Reagan's presidency and throughout President Reagan's illness, Nancy Reagan as a fierce life companion and political companion.
Right, and I think the way she handled this publicly really gave heart to a lot of people. There are a lot of Americans who have gone through tragedies and difficulties with Alzheimer's. And I think both she and President Reagan handled this, the way they talked about it openly, I think it really did make a difference for a lot of people. It took a disease that was a little bit in the shadows and took it out of the shadows and made us understand it better. And I think it probably gave heart to a lot of people going through the same things that the Reagans were. I was very struck, by the way, by the chaplain's prayer. I thought that was a lovely line, to lift liberty's lamp until totalitarian towers tumbled. I have a feeling that's how Ronald Reagan would like to remember himself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part of his legacy that is probably the least partisan and the most embraced by Americans.
The point around which really everyone, it would seem, can agree. Dignitaries now beginning to leave the rotunda, which is to soon open for a flow of the public. Gail Shattuck, have you had a chance to talk with any of the Americans who have come to the Capitol today in hopes of seeing the Reagan cortege or actually passing by the coffin?
Yes. You know, Tom, what's interesting to me is both the people that are here and the people that are not here. I've tried to talk to people that, you know, were hastening away from the area in subways as well as the ones that are here. I think what has drawn a lot of the people that I've talked to here seems to be a really genuine affection for the man. I mean, I've talked to people who are here that don't remember anything he did, literally. Some that are too young to have known him. But they, you know, they're picking up some of the things on the television coverage and the radios, replaying some of his speeches, and they're picking up the humor and the confidence and the dignity. And I think that's what's drawing them. Some of the people that are not coming are, you know, people in D.C., for example, who are trying to raise kids in broken-down school systems in Northeast and did stand in line for Kennedy, but will not do it for President Reagan because they don't feel that he ever cared for them, which is different than, you know, representing the nation with dignity. This is personal. This is, you know, I was reading how the Monitor covered the Kennedy funeral, and our reporters who were covering that described people being told at 1 a.m. that they wouldn't, their place in line wouldn't get them there before 9 in the morning, and they said they just didn't care. You know, this man had meant so much to them personally, but for some of the people I'm talking to that are not there, they say they are remembering that he seems to have stood more for wealth than for them, and that their schools are worse off now than they were, you know, in Kennedy's time. So I think Ejideon is right. There is a political argument that certainly has not been set to rest by this funeral, and that is very much there in the response. I mean, I think you'll see that the crowd that's here isn't quite as racially mixed as it was for President Kennedy, and I think that speaks to some of the underlying politics of the period that we're not talking about much today, but that have not been set to rest.
We will be talking more as this hour progresses exactly about those politics with E.J. Dionne. But E.J., here's the combination of respect and adulation and opposition. Maybe there's no president who entirely unifies a nation, but this one, certainly in his lifetime and in his legacy, at many levels did not.
No, I think Ronald Reagan was and still remains a polarizing figure. I talked to somebody today who said, I don't understand why they're covering all this, doing all this Ronald Reagan coverage. I mean, he's the man who cut my student loans and cut Social Security money from my mother. I mean, in other words, there is, just as Gail said, there are very different memories of Ronald Reagan depending on sometimes which side of the tracks you're on and obviously which side of politics you're on. There are those who've been saying that breaking the PATCO strike was essential to showing authority. There are others who are saying breaking the PATCO strike was the beginning of the destruction of the labor movement and the rise of a period of great inequality. Those are all part of the Reagan legacy that we will be arguing about. And I think in the early days, there was a natural and I think admirable tendency to say, let's focus. This man just died. He clearly is, at some level, a great man because he achieved so much change. So let's hold off on this. But I think as the adulation has continued, and especially as some of the adulation became, at least seemed to the opponents of Mr. Reagan's politics, more and more political, I think there was the beginnings of a reaction, which you're seeing in websites, you're seeing it in responses from the very people Gail talked about who are not at that beautiful funeral today.
And Gail, I know we have you just for another minute, but there is this debate that will go on and by necessity in a democracy go on fiercely in this presidential campaign year, and Ronald Reagan's legacy is no small part of that debate.
It is not. It's his legacy that made possible the Republican Revolution of 94 when they took back the House, and that appears to be much more on the line in November than any of us would have predicted a few months ago.
So, much to be seen and determined for the next 3 days. The remains of the man who wrought that revolution will be in the Capitol Rotunda, where they stand now. The lights of the Capitol have been turned down. Marble statues around the perimeter stand as always. Dignitaries remain. A four-point honor guard and another officer at the head of the casket of Ronald Reagan. Three wreaths now around that casket. And the great public that will surge by in the days ahead. A powerful leader with a powerful legacy that is debated to this day. Gail Shattuck, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Gail Shattuck is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. E.J. Dionne, I hope you'll stay with us.
I'm happy to. Thank you.
It's great to have you. We look forward to digging into the politics of this moment, even as we honor Ronald Reagan at his passing, even as the speeches we heard this evening both honored Ronald Reagan and could not help but brush the politics that he so powerfully represented. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been bringing you live coverage of the state funeral of Ronald Reagan with E.J. Dionne. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about America's political balance of power and the battle for its future in the shadow of Ronald Reagan's funeral. My guest tonight is E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist and senior fellow in government studies at the Brookings Institution. His new book is Stand Up, Fight Back, looking at the balance of political power in the United States today and how it may be changing, how it may not be changing. We've just, like many of you, been watching live coverage of the state funeral of Ronald Reagan on Capitol Hill in the Capitol Rotunda, speeches tonight from Vice President Dick Cheney, from House Speaker Dennis Hastert, and from Alaskan Senator and Senate President Pro Tem Ted Stevens. Let us sit back now, step back, and look at the politics roiling just outside that Capitol Rotunda. As Ronald Reagan is laid to rest this week, the politics of the country he leaves behind may be properly described as more polarized than at the conservative resurgent height of his own presidency. Less middle ground, maybe no middle ground, less civility, sometimes no civility. What do you think? Is Ronald Reagan, even on this day, still framing the American political debate? We invite your thoughts on this night, on the life and legacy of Ronald Reagan. Do Republicans own today the very language of American political conversation? And is that now changing or not? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, E.J. Dionne, we have been watching the pomp and circumstance and honor given to a two-term president who led the country in powerful ways. You are writing these days about that ongoing political debate that really with many of its roots right in Ronald Reagan's presidency, in his legacy. How do you see the political balance in this country today in the shadow of Ronald Reagan's funeral?
Well, I think one of the most important things about Ronald Reagan is that he was and saw himself as the product and the leader of a movement. And in the book Stand Up, Fight Back, I write about how the conservative movement was extremely successful at building institutions and shifting the balance of shifting the way we talked about we talk about politics, and that it took liberals a very, very long time to realize how successful conservatives were in building these institutions. Liberals fell way behind in institution building as the conservatives were putting relentless pressure on the mainstream media, if I can use that term, and then at the same time building their own separate media institutions on talk radio, on cable television. Liberals were not engaged. They weren't lazy, but they weren't engaged in that same kind of work. At the same time, conservatives really did transform the language of politics. You couldn't talk about government without apologizing for it and somehow saying you were for small government, even when you were for a rather large and active government. You had to justify everything in market terms. Somehow the market was supreme. In the book, I quote Ann Lewis, who used to work at the Clinton White House, who once said in jest, you know, we used to talk about immunizing little children against disease. Mm-hmm. Now we call for investments in human capital. That's how much liberals had to sort of decided they had to buy into conservative language. And I think what's happening now, what's happened in the last several years, but particularly in the last year because of a sense of crisis created by the Bush presidency, is liberals, progressives, Democrats have decided that they need to fight back and start creating the same kind of energy and institutions and stop apologizing for their commitments. 1964, when Ronald Reagan gave that very famous speech for Barry Goldwater, it was the conservative movement that was on the run. It didn't get disheartened. It started building. I think at this moment, what you're seeing is liberals and progressives are starting to build and are conscious of the need for a movement.
E.J., it's an interesting, in some ways, difficult evening for this conversation because Ronald Reagan now lies in state. We've just heard his state funeral, and at the same time, he was robustly and proudly always, while he was able, in the thick of this debate, led the Reagan Revolution, of course, and implemented much of it during his administration. At the same time, we're in a presidential season that's all new. It's the year 2004, and there has been a kind of political flux underway. Where do you see the needle tonight in this country? It's often described as evenly red and blue divided, but in terms of dynamism, you look at Republicans, you look at Democrats. Where do you think the needle stands this evening, E.J. Dionne?
Well, you know, it is worth thinking about that Ronald Reagan's election was 24 years ago, and that period included the 8 years of Bill Clinton. And the Clinton years really were not a complete repudiation of Reaganism, but definitely a desire for a turn in a somewhat different direction, a turn back toward the center, if not toward liberalism. And I think George Bush himself recognized when he was elected in 2000 that the precise terms of the Reagan Revolution, and especially the Gingrich Revolution, were no longer applicable to American politics. Ronald Reagan said, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. George Bush did something different. He criticized conservatives for being reflexively anti-government. His formulation was government if necessary, but not necessarily government. I think what happened in the Clinton years was a kind of moderation of the Reagan Revolution and a view that, and I think it emerged very clearly during the government shutdown in the 90s, that, wait a minute, Americans said, there are a lot of things government does that we approve of. And when Clinton ran for reelection, promising to protect Medicare, Medicaid, education, and the environment, that famous M2E2 campaign, mm-hmm. What he was saying, talking about, is that there are things that government does that people don't want to shut down and don't think that in those areas, they don't think government is the problem. It can make mistakes, but it's not the problem. And so I think the Reagan Revolution, more than conservatives like to admit, has been diluted, even if he achieved substantial change. I think the one enduring change of the Reagan Revolution is that the Republican Party is now a frankly conservative party. There used to be, especially up in my native Massachusetts, a lot of people who were proud to call themselves liberal Republicans.
Long
people
ago.
Like Senator Ed Brooke, former Governor Frank Sargent, these were liberal Republicans. Nobody in the Republican Party anymore wants to call themselves liberal, and those who call themselves moderates find themselves increasingly on the defensive. That is one enduring change of the Reagan Revolution. It's actually one that I am not sure is very good for politics, but what it's done is it's pushed a lot of those moderate and liberal Republicans to the other side.
E.J., the very title of your book, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge, speaks to the kind of a high dudgeon of the left-right standoff right now. You write expansively about how effective Republicans have been in the Reagan period and since. You say liberals and Democrats make a great mistake when they simply whine over the conservative achievement. Modern conservatism's success at institution building is worthy of respect. E.J., what can Democrats learn from the Republicans, from Ronald Reagan's example?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is simply the spirit of optimism. Ronald Reagan stole optimism from the Democrats. FDR was the quintessentially optimistic leader. John Kennedy was an optimistic leader. And running as he did in 1980 against Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Carter was a good man presiding over very difficult times. And you tended to remember what Carter said about how difficult the problems we faced were.
The malaise.
You tended to
The malaise.
Yeah, malaise, the famous word. You tended to remember when Ronald Reagan spoke that we can lick these problems, just as you remembered when FDR gave his fireside chats. I think that's another thing that Clinton stole back. He stole back the optimism that Reagan had taken. I think the second thing you learn from Reagan is that if you know where you're going, you can compromise. Reagan was rather flexible at times, but he was never flexible about his objectives. And I think sometimes the Democrats have the problem of saying so much about who they're not, talking so much about who they're not, that no one knows who they are. And it actually makes compromise to get to a particular objective much more difficult. I think the other thing you can learn from Ronald Reagan is that he grew up as a New Dealer and therefore knew Democratic language. There were times, even when he was pursuing anti-New Deal objectives, where he sounded like a Democrat talking to Democrats. I think at this moment, I think what that shows is you can be very firm in your convictions and still find ways of being persuasive to people who don't go into the debate agreeing with you.
We're talking tonight about America's political balance of power and the battle for its future in the shadow of the Ronald Reagan future. You can join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is E.J. Dionne. His new book is Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. Jim is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi. Thank you.
Good evening.
I haven't heard the earlier discussion, so I'm not sure if my comment is totally apropos to what you're all talking about. I wanted to call in and say that personally, I'm getting a little tired of all this incredible adulation of Reagan right now. It seems like everybody is tripping over themselves to sort of say how wonderful he is. And what I remember in 1980 and throughout the 80s is my view of it is that Reagan sort of ushered in the era of denial, which we're still sort of living with. You can be what you say you are, and sort of ignore the facts, whether it has to do with the deficit or the environment or whatever else it is. And I just sort of, as I hear today on the radio at work, I'm listening to, I think it was a Speaker of the House who was suggesting that they name the Pentagon after him, or was that the...
There is a movement to rename the Pentagon after Ronald Reagan. That's right.
Yeah, it just seems like there's a little bit of a lack of perspective and a lack of reason. And I know that's coming from the Republican side of the aisle, but.
But Jim, it is the day of the state funeral of Ronald Reagan. Is there time for a break from the critique here, or are we so much in the midst of this debate that there's no time to step back and simply honor the man? The debate has to go on.
Well, of course, there's time for the debate, or time for a break from the debate, and I have, nothing personally against Ronald Reagan, and he seemed like a very kind and genuine person, but the focus doesn't seem to be just on that. It seems to be on the sort of greater contribution that he made to the country and to the government, and I don't know. I think that. While we're saying all that, I just a little bit of a balance from my view is what I'm interested in.
We hear you loud and clear, and we heard politics even in the speeches tonight in the rotunda. I hear you there, E.J. Dionne.
Yes, I just wanted to tell Jim that we had, in fact, alluded to the fact that there are a lot of people just like Jim out there who are on the other side of the fence from Ronald Reagan and are not happy about saying that all was well in the 1980s, who have real differences with what Reagan did and real differences with what happened in the 1980s. And I think in the midst of all of this, we can admire Ronald Reagan's spirit, but ask the question, wasn't the 80s the beginning of a period of growing inequality, and didn't that create problems for our nation? That was a time when ketchup was redeclared a vegetable, as has been mentioned in the course of this week, so that you could cut the cost of the school lunch program for poor children. So I think Jim is absolutely right. And I think one of the things that feeds the reaction that Jim and folks like him have is the extent to which the speeches that we've heard all week about Ronald Reagan do not sound, just as you said, Tom, they don't just sound like, this was a great guy whom we liked. They are about a political legacy, that essentially they are making an argument that Ronald Reagan was fundamentally right in all important ways about his view of the world. And when people make arguments like that, it is very natural that people who disagree with those arguments are going to dissent and eventually sort of make their own arguments back.
E.J., let me ask you then about your prescription for the Democratic Party in the context of what caller Jim has just raised. You're saying Democrats see this spirit of optimism that Ronald Reagan brought and learn from that. Jim says, you know what? It sounded like optimism, but it surrounded a kernel of denial. Is denial a necessary part of optimism for Democrats?
I don't think optimism goes with denial. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression was quite candid about the depth of the problems the United States faced. I think that, in fact, most effective optimistic political leaders are quite clear about the depth of the problem. Winston Churchill succeeded because he constantly told the British people the bad news and insisted that they would overcome. I think with Democrats, what you've got that is, until recently, you have lacked the kind of solidarity that you had on the right, and you had a whole series of arguments that the Democrats couldn't let go of. I've been saying that there's a line in my book where I say that the Democrats are sometimes like a museum of unforgotten wars, and that they sometimes sound like that stereotypical old couple
who relive fights from 25 years ago just to feel young again. I read that line to my wife, who said, "That's a great line. That isn't us, is it?" And I said, "No, it's not us." And I said, "Besides, we haven't been married long enough for that." You know, but if you look at these fights, big government versus small government, Democrats are a party that favors active government. The real question is, whose side should the government be on? Pro-business versus anti-business. Democrats have that argument all the time. Mm-hmm. Since when have Democrats or liberals been anti-business? One of my favorite cartoons was in The New Yorker of two very wealthy businessmen in their plush chairs at their men's club, and one of them says to the other, "Every time these socialist Democrats take power, I make a pile. I don't understand this." and the issue is not whether you're pro-business or anti-business, but it is, do you think you need rules to make capitalism work, to make it fair, to fight monopoly, to fight cheating? Apropos the Enron scandal. And there are one more that, on my list. I have a list in the book, The Right Stuff and The Wrong Stuff. Mm-hmm. One more on the wrong stuff. The Democrats have these arguments about should we be populist or should we be mainstream? Well, on a lot of questions, the mainstream is populist. Al Gore gave that speech at the Democratic Convention in 2000. He attacked big oil companies, polluters, HMOs, big insurance companies. Does anybody really think he lost votes by going after those interests? He went up in the polls after the convention. So I think a lot of these futile arguments that Democrats have, they have to push aside and begin to make a series of new arguments. And the theme, the organizing theme I propose in the book is the theme of progressive patriotism.
And what do you mean by that, EJ?
Yeah, what I mean by progressive patriotism is the idea that, in its simplest terms, it's the idea that we are all in this together, which is a very simple and old-fashioned idea that I think at the moment is a radical challenge to a status quo that is dividing and failing us. In programmatic terms, I think it leads most of all to a kind of GI Bill politics. The GI Bill is one of my favorite pieces of government legislation. And the reason it's one of my favorite pieces of government legislation is because at one and the same time, it says service to country and mm-hmm. to community is an essential part of citizenship, and we should demand it and also reward it. But at the same time, the GI Bill took millions of people who served our country in the armed forces and gave them an opportunity, gave many who would never have otherwise had an opportunity to enter the middle class or rise higher that chance. We sent people to college. We helped them buy homes. And I think that kind of government investment, in that case, I think investment really is a legitimate word, helped create the great prosperity that we saw in the 1950s and 1960s. So this idea of reciprocity, reward service and encourage it, and at the same time find ways for government to help people to do without help. And there I am stealing a line from John Stuart Mill. And I think that's really old liberalism, and that's a good idea.
Patriotism in the service to country, progressivism in watching out for all citizens' interests.
Right. And, after 9/11, what did we discover? We discovered a sense of solidarity. We discovered that whether you're rich or you're poor, you can be threatened from the outside. And historically, that kind of spirit of solidarity created a desire for greater social justice in the country. One of my favorite movies is a really corny movie. It's A Wonderful Life, the Frank Capra
Sure.
movie. And I think that movie really embodies the kind of values that I'm talking about. It says that, yes, we want a capitalist system. We want people to own their homes. George Bailey is a hero, is a banker, and he's a hero because he helps people buy their homes. Mr. Potter is the evil banker because he really wants to deprive people of that opportunity and that right. And the spirit of that movie comes straight out of World War II.
E.J. Dionne, we've got to hold it right there. We'll be right back. We're talking with E.J. Dionne tonight. Stand Up, Fight Back is the book. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's political balance of power and the battle for its future in the shadow of the Ronald Reagan future. My guest tonight is E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. You are welcome to join our conversation as well tonight. We invite your thoughts on this night, on the life and legacy of Ronald Reagan. Is Ronald Reagan, even on this day of his state funeral, which we've just heard, still framing the American political debate? Do Republicans own the very language of American political conversation? Is that changing or not? Is this the year for a Democratic Party resurgence? Do you feel it? Or is the conservative worldview still dominating? Do you hear a progressive comeback in the game plan of E.J. Dionne? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dave is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Ronald Reagan's legacy. Let's look at it. He made government smaller, but he grew private contractors, which cost us more money, and they have no accountability. So just like what we have going on in Iraq right now. He destroyed the unions by crushing PATCO, which was the start of the demise of the middle class.
This is okay. The air traffic controllers. But, Dave, you heard from the Capitol Rotunda tonight, and we've heard in all the days since Ronald Reagan's passing.
Yeah.
It was the sunny president, the president of optimism, the president who made Americans confident again.
Okay, that might be very true. But then you take a look what he did with deregulation. Look what he did with the deficits ballooning and the monster debt that this country carries. I mean, that's what he's done. He was spend, and pass the bill on to the future. The country is so split, 50% of the people don't even vote, and then we have of the 50% that do vote is split right down the middle. I mean, if George Bush is trying to be like Ronald Reagan, I mean, we have nothing but divisiveness. It isn't we the people, it's we the Republicans or we the Democrats.
Dave, we've got it, and thank you for your call. E.J., there's the voice from Milwaukee saying, I'm not feeling unified even on this night. The division is there. And you say, yes, indeed it is, and it's deep.
Right. I think the caller made some very fair points. And I mean, one of the striking things actually is that President Reagan didn't really succeed in cutting the size of government very much because he did that very, very large defense buildup. In the end, Bill Clinton actually reduced the size of government. Did some more spending cuts than Ronald Reagan did, partly because he did cut that military budget. So even on that level, we can dispute what the Reagan legacy is. But I think this notion of the decline of the middle class, the decline of unions after breaking PATCO, is very much at the heart of this election. You know, people talk about how the numbers we're seeing on the economic recovery, the economy is finally beginning to add jobs. But President Bush's ratings on the economy at the moment aren't very good. Now, some of that is just some spillover from his negative ratings on foreign policy because of the mess in Iraq. But I think we have been for the last few years back to what happened earlier, which is that the prosperity that we had in the country didn't trickle down as it was supposed to people in the middle and the bottom. And I think one of the things about the 1990s, one of the differences between the economic growth in the 1990s, especially at the end of the 90s, and the growth in the 80s, is that it was much better distributed. By the end of the 90s, we were actually beginning to see growth in income, even at the very bottom, folks at the very bottom of the American economy. And I think I actually had a debate on Reaganomics versus Clintonomics with someone a few years ago. And I think that's the fundamental question. An economy with very low unemployment and some real supports for the working poor, the earned income tax credit, a badly named but wonderful program that helps people who go to work make ends meet, those kind of things actually help spread growth more broadly. And I think that's one of the central issues in politics now as it was then. Not do we want to grow? Of course we want to grow. But do we grow in common? Do we grow together? Or do we grow only one part of the economy and do only some people benefit from that growth?
And you're saying Democrats stand up and say it loud and proud. Dana's calling from South Wellfleet on Cape Cod. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi.
That's a lovely place.
Thank you. It is. Thank you. I'm very fortunate to be able to live here by the grace of God and my landlady. Anyway, I would like to say that this legacy, yes, I think unfortunately you're right. I think Reagan has framed the debate much to the detriment of democracy, the processes of democracy, and much to the detriment of the American people. Because it's been largely style over substance, and most people have been bamboozled by this. Oh, he's such a nice man, and he really made us feel good. About what? About murder in Central America by proxy governments, or desecration of the environment, putting working-class people and unemployed people in danger with, cutting back social programs.
But, of course, Dana, that wasn't what it was. It was the wall coming down. It was about an economy that rebounded. It was about...
Well, yeah, I know. But you know what that all is to me? That's all mindless hero worship. America needs a hero. You know, we just mythologize the man without discussing anything. And,
but, you know, the Soviet Union did go away. That's not a myth. It's
well,
a fact.
No, but I think the Soviet Union was ready to implode on itself anyway. Reagan just kind of blew on it. It's not like he was a knight in white horse that sent, you know, at his own risk, you know, sent a lance through. The threat from the Soviet Union was always overrated. I mean, except for the nuclear arms thing, which could have demised both countries. But
so even on the day of the funeral, you're not ready to join the parade?
No, absolutely not. I think all this, like some previous call, all this adulation is nauseating. It's because the real issues are not being discussed. Sorry if I don't appear to have respect for the dead, but especially on, I'm sorry.
Dana, we've got it, and we've got the perspective, and in that, EJ, you can feel just how divided the country has become. I mean, the man has died. The funeral is still going on. The lines are waiting outside the Capitol building, and still, he was so potent that the revolution, if you will, that he set off is still just dividing the country.
No, I think that's right. And I think, if anything, we have become more divided. I mean, I agree with most of the, you know, from my own political point of view, I agree with much of what the last caller said. The one thing I would say is that in some ways we are more divided than we were in the Reagan years. I think that politics is more personalized. I mean, in my book, I talk about 9/11, how it unified us in a way, you know, to a degree that we had not been unified in many years. And I'm very critical of President Bush for then turning around and using 9/11 as a political issue in 2002. And I think it was the decision to use national security in the Iraq War as a political issue in a campaign that divided us more deeply than ever. I've got a chapter in the book called "He's Ours, He's All We've Got." And it comes from a quote from a Democratic political consultant I called a few days after 9/11, about a week or so after. And I said, "How do you feel about Bush these days?" And he said, "Well, you know, I went into church and knelt down and prayed that he be successful, because he's ours, he's all we've got." And when these issues were used in a political way in the 2002 election, Democrats felt slapped in the face, and they felt exploited, and they felt that their, you know, the way in which they had let down their guard had been used to help Republicans win a political victory. And so, in a sense, the anger you're hearing from some of the callers tonight about Ronald Reagan, I think, does reflect real feelings in the ongoing debate over what Reagan in the 1980s meant. But I think they also represent this even deeper divide that we have as we go into the head toward November 2004.
EJ, we've just got a couple of minutes left. Give us your prescription then for the Democrats. What are you saying to this party? If you don't want to live forever in the shadow of Ronald Reagan, if you want to challenge that, you've got a big how-to here. What is it?
Well, first of all, I have started using the word liberal quite a bit, simply because I don't think you should let the other side define terms. And I simply define liberal: if you're a liberal, you believe that government should use its power to help those on the way up and who need to get up, rather than emphasize helping those who are already up. So I think whose side is the government on is a critical question. I think challenging using the judiciary for political purposes, which I think is a very unconservative idea. I think declaring that if individuals should be responsible, so should the federal government. I think the deficits, the way we are financing government, is asking voters who will never have a say in this, i.e. our children, who can't vote on this, to pay for current political gain. You know, to go back to GI Bill politics, government can promote personal initiative and self-sufficiency and help people rise up. And on the international scene, I think one of the problems with President Bush's view, the view that underlay the way we went into Iraq, is that there's this idea that the world is moving against us and that we really have to act alone. In fact, when this century began, the world was, and I think still is, moving toward freedom and democracy. I think we need a certain optimism like Harry Truman's and a creativity in forging alliances to keep democracy moving forward and not to isolate ourselves from the rest of the world. And on these social issues, you know, I talk – one of my favorite descriptions of us as Americans is from Bill Galston, who teaches at the University of Maryland. And he says a good number of Americans are tolerant traditionalists. And by that he means that many of us live in families, raise our kids, don't like them to see porn on television, have fairly conservative values in our own life, but also value and honor the diversity in our society. We don't like people picking on people who are gay or lesbian. I think people hold those two ideas simultaneously and want people to advance it. And, of course, uniting this to me is the idea
of progressive patriotism and insisting that, no, we're not isolated individuals, we're not radical individualists, we believe in a community, and yes, we're all in this together. And I think that resonates with a lot of Americans, including a lot of moderates and even some conservatives who are not, you know, market ideologues. I think a lot of Americans identify with that vision.
E.J. Dionne, it's a big embracing vision. We're going to have to check in with you in the course of this political campaign season to see how you see Democrats holding it up or not holding it up against the challenges that they face in this month and the months ahead. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you. As you know, I always love being on your show and being back in Boston, if only through electronics.
In Boston and across the country, it's great to have you, E.J. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. We are going to close this hour with one last look at tonight's state funeral for President Ronald Reagan. Joining me now is Donald Ritchie, Associate Historian at the Senate Historical Office. Good evening and welcome, Donald Ritchie.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. You've just seen, as many of us have seen and observed and heard, the ceremonies under the Capitol Rotunda. What were your thoughts as you watched these as a historian? Put it in some context for us, Donald Ritchie.
Well, it was a very solemn moment, and it had reflections. I remember as a young man, a college student, watching the Kennedy state funeral in 1963. Mm-hmm. And I've seen other funerals in the Rotunda for Hubert Humphrey and for Claude Pepper over times and for the two police officers who died in 1998. And each one of them is very moving in the setting and in the solemnity of the people who are gathered there. There's some special moment about it. I felt a lot of connection to those previous occasions when I watched the proceedings tonight.
You're an historian, but look ahead with us just a little bit. We heard earlier that each president essentially plans his or maybe one day her own funeral. That Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and George H.W. Bush all have plans on file already. Are we likely to see this kind of big, grand state funeral for a president again, or do you expect funerals of a different style for each of these former presidents?
I think there will be certain similarities and many differences. For instance, President Truman and President Lyndon Johnson died about a month apart. And Mrs. Truman chose not to have a state funeral in Washington. She was quite elderly at the time and just didn't want to come back to Washington. Mm-hmm. She frankly didn't like Washington even when he was president.
Right.
But Mrs. Johnson felt that her husband's whole career had been in the U.S. Capitol and that he really needed to, in a sense, finish his life in the Capitol. And she wanted a full state funeral. So we may see, regardless of the wishes of the presidents, we may see some variations depending on what the individual families felt. The Nixon family, for instance, did not choose a full state funeral in Washington. So it's hard to predict exactly what the future will bring. But if there is another state funeral, it will have many of the same trappings because these actually date back to the days of Abraham Lincoln.
We've just got a minute left, but what about the tone of the remarks in the rotunda this evening? Did you hear them as in line with the kind of remarks that are typically made at the funeral of a former president?
Yes, you know, they were very personal remarks, and I thought again back to the Kennedy funeral, and when Mike Mansfield, one of John Kennedy's best friends in the Senate, gave probably one of the most moving eulogies, the one that was eventually set to music even, that there was something went beyond statescraft, and it went to the personal connection. And I think that each one of the speakers today had a personal connection to President Reagan, and that came through in the remarks. They were more than just sort of hollow oratory. There was something very personal there.
Something personal and something still very alive in the politics, that there is a vision that they continue to celebrate even at the site of the casket.
And he's now becoming much more of a symbol, especially for his party.
In funerals, I guess, such symbols are born or certainly burnished. Donald Ritchie, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Donald Ritchie, Associate Historian for the United States Senate. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.